he is painting tonight, stroke by stroke, like Harold and his purple crayon drawing a balloon as he falls. Floating in the North Atlantic, Scott realizes that he has never been more clear about who he is, his purpose. It's so obvious. He was put on this earth to conquer this ocean, to save this boy. Fate brought him to that beach in San Francisco 41 years ago. It delivered to him a golden god, shackled at the wrists, battling the ocean winds. Fate gave Scott the urge to swim, to join first his junior high swim team, then his high school and college crews. It pushed him to swim practice every morning at 5, before the sun was up, lap after lap in the chlorinated blue, the applause of the other boys splashing, the cree of the coach's whistle. Fate led him to water, but it was will that drove him to victory in 3 state championships, will that pushed him to a first-place medal in the men's 200-meter freestyle in high school. He came to love the pressure in his ears when he dove down to the pool's apple-smooth bottom. He dreamed of it at night, floating like a buoy in the blue. And when he started painting in college, blue was the first color he bought. He is starting to get thirsty when the boy says, "What's that?" Scott lifts his head from the water. The boy is pointing at something to their right. Scott looks over. In the moonlight, Scott sees a hulking black wave creeping silently toward them, growing taller, gathering strength. Scott measures it instantly at 25 feet, a monster bearing down. Its humped head sparkles in the moonlight. A lightning bolt of panic hits him. There is no time to think. Scott turns and starts swimming toward it. He has maybe 30 seconds to close the gap. His left shoulder screams at him, but he ignores it. The boy is crying now, sensing that death is near, but there isn't time to comfort him. "Deep breath!" Scott yells. "Take a deep breath, now!" The wave is too big, too fast. It is on them before Scott can get a good breath himself. He pulls the boy from the flotation device and dives. Something in his left shoulder pops. He ignores it. The boy struggles against him, against the madman, dragging him down to his death. Scott grips him tighter and kicks. He is a bullet, a cannonball streaking down through the water, diving under a wall of death. The pressure increases. His heart pounds, his lungs tick, swollen with air. As the wave passes overhead, Scott is certain he has failed. He feels himself being sucked back up to the surface in a maelstrom of undertow. The wave will chew them up, he realizes, rip them apart. He kicks harder, holding the boy to his chest, fighting for every inch. Overhead, the wave crests and topples into the sea behind them. 25 feet of ocean falling like a hammer, millions of gallons of angry surge, and the updraft is replaced in an instant by a churning rinse cycle. They are spun and dragged. Down becomes up. Pressure threatens to rip them apart, man from boy, but Scott holds on. His lungs are screaming now. His eyes are burning from the salt. In his arms, the boy has stopped struggling. The ocean is pure blackness, no sign of the stars or moon. Scott releases the air in his lungs and feels the bubbles cascade downward across his chin and arms. With all his strength, he flips them over and kicks for the surface. He emerges, coughing, his lungs half full of water. He screams them clear. The boy is limp in his arms, his head lying inert against Scott's shoulder. Scott turns the boy until his back is against Scott's chest, and then, with all his strength, compresses the boy's lungs in rhythm until he, too, is coughing up salt water. The seat cushion is gone, chewed up by the wave. Scott holds the boy with his good arm. Cold and exhaustion threaten to overwhelm him. For a time, it's all he can do just to keep them afloat.
"That was a big bad guy," the boy says finally.
For a moment, Scott doesn't understand the words.
but then it comes back to him. He told the boy that the waves were bad guys, and they were the heroes.
So brave, Scott thinks, amazed. I could really go for a cheeseburger, he says in the calm between waves. What about you?
Pie,
the boy says after a moment.
What kind?
All of them.
Scott laughs. He cannot believe that he is still alive. He feels giddy for a moment, his body thrumming with energy. For the second time tonight, he has faced certain death and lived. He looks for the North Star.
How much longer?
The boy wants to know.
It's not far, Scott tells him, though the truth is they could still be miles from shore.
I'm cold,
says the boy, his teeth chattering. Scott hugs him.
Me too. Hold on, okay?
He maneuvers the boy onto his back, working to stay above the spray. The boy hugs Scott's neck, his breath loud in Scott's ear.
Finish strong, Scott says, as much for himself as the boy.
He gives one more look to the sky, then starts to swim. He uses a side stroke now, scissoring his legs, one ear submerged in the salty murk. His movements are clumsier, jerky. He can't seem to find a rhythm. Both of them are shivering, their core temperature falling with every passing second. It is just a matter of time. Soon his pulse and respiration will slow, even as his heart rate increases. Hypothermia will quicken its pace. A massive heart attack is not out of the question. The body needs warmth to operate. Without it, his major organs will start to fail.
Don't give up. Never give up.
He swims without pause, teeth chattering, refusing to surrender. The weight of the boy threatens to sink him, but he kicks harder with his rubbery legs. Around him, the sea is bruised purple and midnight blue, the cold white of the wave caps glimmering in the moonlight. The skin of his legs has started to chafe in the spots where they rub together, the salt doing its insidious damage. His lips are cracked and dry. Above them, seagulls chatter and glide like vultures waiting for the end. They mock him with their cries, and in his mind, he tells them all to go to hell. There are things in the sea that are impossibly old, astonishingly large, great undersea rivers pulling warm water up from the Gulf of Mexico. The Atlantic Ocean is a nexus of highways, of undersea flyovers and bypasses. And there, like a speck on a dot on a flea, is Scott Burrows, shoulders screaming as he fights for his life. After what feels like hours, the boy shouts a single word.
Land!
For a moment, Scott isn't sure the boy actually spoke. It must be a dream. But then the boy repeats the word, pointing.
Land!
It seems like a mistake. Like the boy has mixed up the word for survival with the word for something else. Scott lifts his head, half blind with exhaustion. Behind them, the sun is starting to rise, a gentle pinkening to the sky. At first, Scott thinks the landmass ahead of them is just some low-hanging clouds on the horizon. But then he realizes that he is the one who's moving.
Land. Miles of it. Open beach curving toward a rocky point. Streets and houses. Cities. Salvation.
Scott resists the urge to celebrate. There is still a mile to go at least, a hard mile against riptides and undertow. His legs are quivering, his left arm numb. And yet he can't help but feel a surge of elation.
He did it. He saved them. How is that possible?
30 minutes later, a graying man in his underwear stumbles out of the surf, carrying a 4-year-old boy. They collapse together onto the sand. The sun is up now, thin white clouds framed against a deep Mediterranean blue. The temperature is somewhere around 68 degrees, gulls hanging weightless in the breeze. The man lies panting, a heaving torso ringed with useless rubber limbs. Now that they're here, he cannot move another inch. He is done. Curled up against his chest, the boy is crying softly.
It's okay, Scott tells him. We're safe now. We're going to be okay.
There is an empty lifeguard station a few feet away. The sign on the back reads Montauk State Beach. New York. He swam all the way to New York. Scott smiles, a smile of pure, joyous, fuck you.
Well, hell, he thinks. It's going to be a beautiful day.
A wall-eyed fisherman drives them to the hospital. The three crowd together on the worn bench seat of his pickup, bouncing on battered shocks. Scott is pantless and shoeless, without money or ID. Both he and the boy are racked with bone-deep chills. They have been in 60-degree water for almost 8 hours. Hypothermia has made them slow-witted and mute. The fisherman speaks to them eloquently in Spanish about Jesus Christ. The radio is on, mostly static. Beneath their feet, wind whistles into the cabin through a rust hole in the floor. Scott pulls the boy to him and tries to warm him through friction, rubbing the child's arms and back vigorously with his one good hand. On the beach, Scott told the fisherman in his limited Spanish that the boy was his son. It seemed easier than trying to explain the truth, that they are strangers drawn together by a freak accident. Scott's left arm is completely useless now. Pain knifes through his body with every pothole, leaving him dizzy and nauseous.
You're okay, he tells himself, repeating the words over and over. You made it.
But deep down, he still can't believe they survived.
Gracias,
he stutters, as the pickup pulls into the crescent driveway of the Montauk Hospital emergency room. Scott bucks the door open with his good shoulder and climbs down, every muscle in his body numb with exhaustion. The morning fog is gone, and the warm sun on his back and legs feels almost religious. Scott helps the boy jump down. Together, they limp into the emergency room. The waiting area is mostly empty. In the corner, a middle-aged man holds an ice pack to his head, water dripping off his wrist onto the linoleum floor. On the other side of the room, an elderly couple holds hands, their heads close together. From time to time, the woman coughs into a balled-up Kleenex she keeps clutched tightly in her left hand. An intake nurse sits behind glass. Scott limps over to her, the boy holding on to his shirt tails.
Hi, he says.
The nurse gives him a quick once-over. Her name tag reads Melanie. Scott tries to imagine what he must look like. All he can think of is Wile E. Coyote after an Acme rocket has exploded in his face.
We were in a plane crash, he says.
The words out loud are astonishing. The intake nurse squints at him.
I'm sorry?
A plane from Martha's Vineyard, a private plane. We crashed into the sea. I think we're hypothermic, and I can't move my left arm. The collarbone may be broken.
The nurse is still trying to work through it.
You crashed in the sea.
We swam. I swam. I think it was 10 miles. Maybe 15. We just came ashore maybe an hour ago. A fisherman drove us here.
The words are making him dizzy, his lungs shutting down.
Look, he says, do you think we could get some help? At least the boy? He's only 4.
The nurse looks at the boy, damp, shivering.
Is he your son?
If I say yes, will you get us a doctor?
The nurse sniffles.
There's no need to get surly.
Scott feels his jaw clenching.
There is actually every need. We were in a fucking plane crash. Get the damn doctor.
She stands, uncertain. Scott glances over at the ceiling-mounted television. The sound is down, but on screen are images of search and rescue boats on the ocean. A banner headline reads, "Private plane feared lost."
"There," says Scott, pointing. "That's us. Will you believe me now?"
The nurse looks at the TV, images of fractured wreckage bobbing in the sea. Her reaction is instantaneous, as if Scott has produced a passport at the border crossing after pantomiming a frantic search. She pushes the intercom button.
"Code Orange," she says. "I need all available doctors to intake immediately."
The cramping in Scott's leg is beyond critical. He is dehydrated, potassium deficient, like a marathoner who has failed to give his body the nutrition it demands.
"Just," he says, buckling to the floor, "one would do, probably."
He lies on the cool linoleum looking up at the boy. The boy's face is sober, worried. Scott tries to smile reassuringly, but even his lips are exhausted. In an instant, they are surrounded by hospital personnel, voices shouting. Scott feels himself being lifted onto a gurney. The boy's hand slips away.
"No!"
the boy shouts. He is screaming, thrashing. A doctor is talking to him, trying to make the boy understand that they will take care of him, that nothing bad will happen. It doesn't matter. Scott struggles to sit up.
"Kid," he says, louder and louder until the boy looks at him. "It's okay. I'm here."
He climbs down off the gurney, his legs rubbery, barely able to stand.
"Sir," a nurse says, "you have to lie down."
"I'm fine," Scott tells the doctors. "Help him." To the boy, he says, "I'm here. I'm not going anywhere." The boy's eyes in daylight are startlingly blue. After a moment, he nods. Scott, feeling lightheaded, turns to the doctor.
"We should do this fast," he says, "if it's not too much trouble."
The doctor nods. He is young and smart. You can see it in his eyes.
"Fine," he says, "but I'm getting you a wheelchair."
Scott nods. A nurse wheels over the chair, and he falls into it.
"Are you his father?"
she asks him as they roll to the exam room.
"No," Scott tells her. "We just met."
Inside the exam bay, the doctor gives the boy a quick once-over, checking for fractures, light in the eyes.
"Follow my finger." "We need to start an IV," he tells Scott. "He's severely dehydrated."
"Hey, buddy," Scott tells the boy. "The doctor needs to put a needle in your arm, okay? They need to give you some fluids and, vitamins."
"No needles,"
the boy says, fear in his eyes. He is one wrong word away from losing his mind.
"I don't like them either," says Scott. "But you know what? I'll get one too, okay? We'll do it together. How about that?"
The boy thinks about this. It seems fair. He nods.
"Okay, good," says Scott. "Let's hold my hand and don't look, okay?"
Scott turns to the doctor.
"Can you do us together?" he asks.
The doctor nods, issues orders. The nurses ready the needles and hang IV bags on metal arms.
"Look at me," Scott tells the boy when the time comes.
The boy's eyes are blue saucers. He flinches when the needle goes in. His eyes tear up, and his bottom lip quivers, but he doesn't cry.
"You're my hero," Scott tells him. "My absolute hero."
Scott can feel the fluids entering his system. Almost immediately, the urge to pass out dissipates.
"I'm going to give you both a mild sedative," the doctor says. "Your bodies have been working overtime just to stay warm. You need a downshift."
"I'm fine," Scott says. "Do him first." The doctor sees there's no point in arguing. A needle is inserted into the boy's IV line.
"You're going to rest a little bit," Scott tells him. "I'll be right here. I may go outside for a minute, but I'll come back, okay?"
The boy nods. Scott touches the crown of his head. He remembers when he was 9 and he fell out of a tree and broke his leg. How he was brave through the whole thing, but when his dad showed up at the hospital, Scott started bawling. And now this boy's parents are most likely dead. No one is going to walk through the door and give him permission to fall apart. "That's good," he tells the boy as his little eyes start to flutter shut. "You're doing so good." After the boy is asleep, Scott is wheeled into a separate exam room. They lay him on a gurney and cut off his shirt. His shoulder feels like an engine that has seized. "How are you feeling?" the doctor asks him. He is maybe 38, with smile lines around his eyes. "You know," says Scott, "things are starting to turn around." The doctor does a surface exam, checking for obvious cuts or bruises. "Did you really swim all that way in the dark?" Scott nods. "Do you remember anything?" "I'm a little fuzzy on details," Scott tells him. The doctor checks his eyes. "Hit your head?" "I think so. On the plane before we crashed." The pen light blinds him for a moment. The doctor clucks. "My response looks good. I don't think you have a concussion." Scott exhales. "I don't think I could have done that. Swim all night with a concussion." The doctor considers this. "You're probably right." As he warms up and his fluids are replaced, things start to come back to Scott. The world at large. The concept of countries and citizens. Of daily life. The internet. Television. He thinks of his three-legged dog staying with a neighbor. How close she came to never eating another under-the-table meatball again. Scott's eyes fill with tears. He shakes them off. "What's the news saying?" he asks. "Not much. They say the plane took off around 10 o'clock last night. Air traffic control had it on their radar for maybe 15 minutes, then it just disappeared. No mayday, nothing. They were hoping the radio was broken and you made an emergency landing someplace. But then a fishing boat spotted a piece of the wing." For a moment, Scott is back in the ocean, treading water in the inky deep, surrounded by orange flames. "Any other survivors?" he asks. The doctor shakes his head. He is focused on Scott's shoulder. "Does this hurt?" he says, gently lifting Scott's arm. The pain is instantaneous. Scott yells. "Let's get an X-ray and a CAT scan," the doctor tells the nurse. He turns to Scott. "I ordered a CAT scan for the boy, too," he says. "I want to make sure there's no internal bleeding." He lays a hand on Scott's arm. "You saved his life," he says. "You know that, right?" For the second time, Scott fights back tears. He is unable, for a long moment, to say anything. "I'm going to call the police," the doctor tells him. "Let them know you're here. If you need anything, anything, tell the nurse. I'll be back to check on you in a few." Scott nods. "Thanks," he says. The doctor stares at Scott for a moment longer, then shakes his head. "God damn," he says, smiling. The next hour is filled with tests. Flush with warm fluids, Scott's body temperature returns to normal. They give him Vicodin for the pain, and he floats for a while in twilight oblivion. It turns out his shoulder is dislocated, not broken. The procedure to pop it back into place is an epic lightning strike of violence, followed immediately by a cessation of pain so intense, it's as if the damage has been erased from his body retroactively. At Scott's insistence, they put him in the boy's room. Normally, children stay in a separate wing, but an exception is made given the circumstances. The boy is awake now, eating Jell-O, when they wheel Scott inside. "Any good?" Scott wants to know.
"Green,"
the boy says, frowning. Scott's bed is by the window. He has never felt anything as comfortable as these scratchy hospital sheets. Across the street, there are trees and houses. Cars drive past, windshields flashing. In the bike lane, a woman jogs against traffic. In a nearby yard, a man in a blue ball cap push-mows his lawn. It seems impossible, but life goes on.
You slept, huh? Says Scott.
The boy shrugs.
Is my mommy here yet?
He says.
Scott tries to keep his face neutral.
No, Scott tells him.
They've called your... I guess you have an aunt and uncle in Connecticut?
They're on their way. The boy smiles.
Ellie,
he says.
You like her?
She's funny,
the boy says.
Funny is good, says Scott, his eyelids fluttering.
Exhausted doesn't describe the kind of heavy metal gravity pulling at his bones right now.
I'm gonna sleep for a bit if that's okay.
If the boy thinks otherwise, Scott never hears it. He is asleep before the kid can answer. He sleeps for a while, a dreamless slumber like a castle dungeon. When he wakes, the boy's bed is empty. Scott panics. He is half out of bed when the bathroom door opens and the boy comes out wheeling his IV stand.
I had to tinkle,
he says. A nurse comes in to check Scott's blood pressure. She's brought a stuffed animal for the boy, a brown bear with a red heart in its paws. He takes it with a happy sound and immediately starts to play.
Kids,
the nurse says, shaking her head. Scott nods. Now that he's slept, he is anxious to get more details about the crash. He asks the nurse if he can get out of bed. She nods, but tells him not to go too far.
I'll be back, buddy, okay?
The boy nods, playing with his bear. Scott puts a thin cotton robe over his hospital gown and walks his IV stand down the hall to the empty patient lounge. It's a narrow interior room with particle board chairs. Scott finds a news channel on TV, turns up the volume. The plane was an Osprey, manufactured in Kansas. On board were David Bateman, president of ALC News, and his family. Also confirmed now as passengers are Ben Kipling and his wife Sarah. Kipling was a senior partner at Wyatt Hathaway, the financial giant. Again, the plane is believed to have gone down in the Atlantic Ocean off the coast of New York sometime after 10 p.m. last night. Scott stares at the footage, helicopter shots of gray ocean swells, Coast Guard boats and rubbernecking weekend sailors. Even though he knows the wreckage would have drifted, maybe even 100 miles by now, he can't help but think that he was down there not that long ago, an abandoned buoy bobbing in the dark. Reports are coming in now, says the anchor, that Ben Kipling may have been under investigation by the Treasury Department's Office of Foreign Assets Control and that charges were forthcoming. The scope and source of the investigation aren't yet clear. More on this story as it develops. A photo of Ben Kipling appears on the screen, younger and with more hair. Scott remembers the eyebrows. He realizes that everyone else on that plane except he and the boy exist now only in the past tense. The thought makes the hair on his neck flutter and stand, and for a moment he thinks he may pass out. Then there is a knock on the door. Scott looks up. He sees a group of men in suits hovering in the hallway.
Mr. Burroughs, says the knocker.
He is in his early 50s, an African-American man with graying hair.
I'm Gus Franklin with the National Transportation Safety Board.
Scott starts to stand, a reflex of social protocol.
No, please, says Gus. You've been through a lot.
Scott settles back onto the sofa, pulling the cotton robe closed over his legs.
I was just watching it on TV, he says. The rescue. Salvage? I'm not sure what to call it. I think I'm still in shock.
Of course, says Gus. He looks around the small room.
I'm gonna say 4 people max in this room, he tells his cohorts. Otherwise, it's gonna get a little claustrophobic.
There is a quick conference. Ultimately, they agree on 6, Gus and 2 others, 1 man and 1 woman, in the room. 2 more in the doorway. Gus sits beside Scott on the sofa. The woman is to the left of the television. A trim, bearded man to her right. They are, for want of a better word, nerds. The woman has a ponytail and glasses. The man sports an $8 haircut and a JCPenney suit. The two men in the doorway are more serious, well-dressed, military haircuts.
As I said, says Gus, I'm with the NTSB. Leslie's with the FAA and Frank is with Osprey. And in the doorway is Special Agent O'Brien from the FBI and Barry Hex from the Treasury's OFAC. The OFAC, says Scott.
I just saw something about that on the TV. Hex chews gum silently.
If you feel up to it, Mr. Burroughs, says Gus, we'd like to ask you some questions about the flight, who was on it, and the circumstances leading up to the crash.
Assuming it was a crash, says O'Brien, and not an act of terrorism. Gus ignores this.
Here's what I know, he tells Scott. As of now, we've found no other survivors, nor have we recovered any bodies. A few pieces of wreckage were found floating about 29 miles off the coast of Long Island. We're examining them now.
He leans forward, placing his hands on his knees.
You've been through a lot, so if you want to stop, just say so.
Scott nods.
Somebody said the boy's aunt and uncle are coming from Connecticut, he says. Do we know when they'll get here?
Gus looks at O'Brien, who ducks out of the room.
We're checking that for you, says Gus.
He pulls a file folder from his briefcase.
So the first thing I need to do is confirm how many people were on the flight.
Don't you have, an itinerary? Scott asks.
Private jets file flight plans, but their passenger rosters are pretty unreliable.
He looks over his paperwork.
Am I right in saying your name is Scott Burroughs?
Yes.
Do you mind giving me your Social Security number for our records?
Scott recites the number. Gus writes it down.
Thanks, he says. That helps. There are 16 Scott Burroughs in the tri-state area. We weren't sure exactly which one we were dealing with.
He offers Scott a smile. Scott tries to work up an encouraging response.
From what we've been able to piece together, Gus tells him, the flight was crewed by a captain, a first officer, and a flight attendant. Would you recognize the names if I said them?
Scott shakes his head. Gus makes a note.
Passenger-wise, says Gus, we know that David Bateman chartered the flight and that he and his family, wife Maggie, and two children, Rachel and JJ, were on board.
Scott thinks of the smile Maggie gave him when he boarded. Warm and welcoming. A woman he knew in passing. Small talk at the market. How are you? How are the kids? The occasional conversation about his work. That she is dead right now at the bottom of the Atlantic makes him want to throw up.
And finally, says Gus, in addition to yourself, we believe that Ben Kipling and his wife Sarah were on board. Can you confirm that?
Yes, says Scott. I met them when I got on the plane.
Describe Mr. Kipling for me, please, asks Agent Hex.
Maybe 5'11", gray hair. He had, very prominent eyebrows. I remember that. And his wife was very chatty.
Hex looks at O'Brien, nods.
And just so we're clear, says Gus, why were you on the plane?
Scott looks at their faces. They are detectives scrambling for facts, filling in missing pieces. A plane has crashed. Was it mechanical failure? Human error? Who can be blamed? Who is liable?
I was, says Scott,
then starts again. I met Maggie, Mrs. Bateman, on the island a few weeks ago, at the farmer's market. I went there every morning for a coffee and a bialy. And she would come in with the kids, but sometimes alone. Then we started talking one day.
Were you sleeping with her? Asks O'Brien.
Scott thinks about this.
I wasn't, he says. Not that it's relevant.
Let us decide what's relevant, O'Brien says.
Sure, says Scott. Though maybe you can explain to me how the sexual interactions of a passenger in a plane crash are relevant to your, what is this, investigation?
Gus nods quickly three times. They are getting off course. Every second wasted takes them farther from the truth.
Back to the point, he says.
Scott holds O'Brien's eye for a long, antagonistic moment, then continues. I ran into Maggie again Sunday morning. I told her I had to go to New York for a few days. She invited me to fly with them.
And why were you going to New York?
I'm a painter. I live on the vineyard, and I was going in to meet with my rep and talk to some galleries about doing a show. My plan was to take the ferry to the mainland, but Maggie invited me and, well, a private plane. The whole thing seemed very... I almost didn't go.
But you did.
Scott nods.
At the last minute, I threw some things together. They were actually closing the doors when I ran up.
Lucky for the boy you made it,
says Leslie from the FAA. Scott thinks about it. Was it lucky? Is there anything lucky about surviving a tragedy?
Did Mr. Kipling seem agitated to you? Hex interjects, clearly impatient.
He has his own investigation, and it has little to do with Scott. Gus shakes him off.
Let's do this in order, he says. I'm leading this. It's my investigation.
He turns to Scott.
The airport log says the plane took off at 10:06.
Sounds right, says Scott. I didn't look at my phone.
Can you describe the takeoff?
It was smooth. I mean, it was my first private jet.
He looks at Frank, the Osprey rep.
Very nice, he says. Except for the crashing, I mean.
Frank looks stricken.
So you don't remember anything unusual? Gus asks. Any sounds or jostling out of the ordinary?
Scott thinks back. It happened so fast. Before he could even get his seatbelt on, they were taxiing. And Sarah Kipling was talking to him, asking him about his work and how he knew Maggie. And the girl was on her iPhone listening to music or playing a game. The boy was sleeping. And Kipling was... What was he doing?
I don't think so, he says. I remember you felt the force of it more. The power. I guess that's what a jet is, but then we were off the ground and rising. Most of the shades were closed and it was very light in the cabin. There was a baseball game on the TV.
Boston played last night, says O'Brien.
Dworkin, says Frank in a knowing way. And the two feds in the doorway smile.
I don't know what that means, Scott says. But I also remember music, something jazzy. Sinatra, maybe?
And did there come a time when something unusual happened? Gus asks.
Well, we fell into the ocean, says Scott.
Gus nods.
And how exactly did that happen?
Well... I mean, it's hard to remember exactly, Scott tells him. The plane turned suddenly, pitched, and I...
Take your time, says Gus.
Scott thinks back. The takeoff. The offered glass of wine. Images flash through his mind. An astronaut's vertigo. A blare of sounds. Metal shrieking. The disorienting whirl. Like a movie negative that has been cut and reassembled at random. It is the job of the human brain to assemble all the input of our world, sights, sounds, smells, into a coherent narrative. This is what memory is, a carefully calibrated story that we make up about our past. But what happens when those details crumble? Hailstones on a tin roof. Fireflies firing at random. What happens when your life can't be translated into a linear narrative?
There was banging, he says. I think.
some kind of, I want to say, concussion.
Like an explosion?
Asks the man from Osprey, hopefully.
No. I mean, I don't think so. It was more like a knocking, and then, at the same time, the plane kind of dropped.
Gus thinks about saying something then, a follow-up question, but doesn't. In his mind, Scott hears a scream, not of terror, but an involuntary expulsion, a reflexive vocal reaction to something unexpected. It is the sound fear makes when it first appears, the sudden, visceral realization that you are not safe, that this activity you are engaged in is deeply, deeply risky. Your body makes the sound, and immediately you break out in a cold sweat. Your sphincter clenches. Your mind, which up until this moment has been moving along at pedestrian speeds, suddenly races forward, running for its life. Fight or flight. It is the moment when the intellect fails and something primal, animal, takes over. With a sudden prickling certainty, Scott realizes that the scream came from him. And then blackness. His face pales. Gus leans in.
Do you want to stop?
Scott exhales. No, it's fine. Gus asks an aide to bring Scott a soda from the machine. While they're waiting, Gus lays out the facts he's managed to assemble.
According to our radar, he says, the plane was in the air for 15 minutes, 41 seconds. It reached an altitude of 12,000 feet, then began to descend rapidly.
Sweat is dripping down Scott's back. Images are coming back to him. Memories. Things were... flying is the wrong word, he says. Around. Stuff. I remember my duffel bag. It just kind of levitated off the floor. Just calmly floated up in the air like a magic trick. And then, just as I reached for it, it just took off, just disappeared. And we were spinning. And I hit my head, I guess.
Do you know if the plane broke up in the air?
Leslie from the FAA asks him.
Or was the pilot able to make a landing?
Scott tries to remember, but it's just flashes. He shakes his head. Gus nods.
Okay, he says. Let's stop there.
Hold on, says O'Brien. I still have questions.
Gus stands.
Later, he says. Right now I think Mr. Burroughs needs to rest.
The others stand. This time, Scott gets to his feet. His legs are shaking. Gus offers his hand.
Get some sleep, he says. I saw two news vans pull up outside as we were coming in. This is going to be a story, and you're going to be at the center of it.
Scott can't, for the life of him, figure out what he's talking about.
What do you mean? He says. We'll try to shield your identity as long as possible, Gus tells him. Your name wasn't on the passenger roster, which helps. But the press is going to want to know how the boy made it to shore. Who saved him? Because that's a story. You're a hero now, Mr. Burroughs. Try to wrap your mind around that, what it means. Plus, the boy's father, Bateman, was a big deal.
And Kipling?
Well, you'll see. This is a very messy situation.
He extends his hand. Scott shakes it.
I've seen a lot of things in my day, says Gus. But this...
He shakes his head.
You're a hell of a swimmer, Mr. Burroughs.
Scott feels numb. Gus herds the other agents out of the room with his hands.
We'll talk again, he says.
After they're gone, Scott sways on his feet inside the empty lounge. His left arm is in a polyurethane sling. The room is buzzing with silence. He takes a deep breath, lets it out. He is alive. This time yesterday he was eating lunch on his back porch and staring out at the yard, egg salad and iced tea. The three-legged dog was lying in the grass licking her elbow. There were phone calls to make, clothes to pack. Now everything has changed. He wheels his IV over to the window, looks out. In the parking lot, he sees 6 news vans, satellite dishes deployed. A crowd is gathering. How many times has the world been interrupted by the cable buzz of special reports? Political scandals, spree killings, celebrity intercourse caught on tape. Talking heads with their perfect teeth ripping apart the still warm body. Now it is his turn. Now he is the story, the bug under the microscope. To Scott, watching through tempered glass, they are an enemy army massing at the gates. He stands in his turret, watching them assemble their siege engines and sharpen their swords. All that matters, he thinks, is that the boy be saved from that. A nurse knocks on the door of the lounge. Scott turns.
Okay, she tells him. Time to rest.
Scott nods. He remembers the moment from last night when the fog first cleared and the North Star became visible. A distant point of light that brought with it absolute certainty about which direction they should go. Standing there, studying his reflection in the glass, Scott wonders if he will ever have that kind of clarity again. He takes a last look at the growing mob, then turns and walks back to his room. List of the Dead. David Bateman, 56. Margaret Bateman, 36. Rachel Bateman, 9. Gil Baruch, 48. Ben Kipling, 52. Sarah Kipling, 50. James Melody, 50. Emma Leitner, 25. Charlie Bush, 30. David Bateman, April 2, 1959 to August 23, 2015. It was the chronic chaos that made it interesting. The way a story could spark from a cinder and race through a news cycle, changing speed and direction, growing wilder, devouring everything in its path. Political gaffes, school shootings, crises of national and international import. News, in other words. On the 10th floor of the ALC building, the newsmen rooted for fires, both literal and metaphoric, betting money on them like a back-alley dice game. Anyone who could guess the length of a scandal down to the hour got a salad spinner, David used to say. Cunningham would give you the watch off his wrist if you could predict a politician's apology word for word before it happened. Napoleon offered sex with his wife to any reporter who could get a White House press secretary to curse into an open mic. They spent hours establishing the ground rules on that one. What constituted a curse? Fuck? Sure. Shit or twat, but what about damn? Was hell enough? Hell will get you a hand job, Napoleon told them, feet stacked up on his desk, left over right. But when Cindy Bainbridge got Ari Fleischer to say it, Napoleon told her it didn't count because she was a girl. If you were lucky, what started as a brush fire, a governor's name found on the client list of a call girl ring, for example, quickly became a raging inferno, exploding in backdraft share points and swallowing all the oxygen out of the broadcast market. David used to remind them constantly that Watergate started with a simple B&E. What was Whitewater, after all, he'd say, but a Bush League podunk land scandal? They were 21st century newsmen, prisoners of the cycle. History had taught them to dig for scandal in the fringes of every fact. Everyone was dirty. Nothing was simple except for the message. ALC News, with a staff of 15,000 and a viewership that hovered around 2 million a day, was founded in 2002 with a $100 million investment by an English billionaire. David Bateman was its architect, its founding father. In the trenches, they called him the chairman. But really what he was a general, like George S. Patton, who stood unflinchingly as machine gun fire strafed the dirt between his legs. David had worked on both sides of the political scandal racket in his day.
First, in his role as a political consultant running to stay ahead of the gaffes and missteps of his candidates. And then, after he retired from politics, in constructing an upstart 24-hour news network. That was 13 years ago. 13 years of outrage and messaging, of jeering chirons and knockdown drag-out war. 4,745 days of constant signal. 113,880 hours of sports and punditry and weather. 6,832,800 minutes of TikTok air to fill with words and pictures and sound. The sheer endless volume of it was daunting sometimes, hour after hour stretching out to eternity. What saved them was that they were no longer slaves to the events they covered, no longer held hostage by the action or inaction of others. This was the big idea that David had brought to the table in constructing the network, his masterstroke. Sitting down for lunch with the billionaire all those years ago, he laid it out simply.
All these other networks, he said, they react to the news, chase after it. We're going to make the news.
What that meant, he said, was that unlike CNN or MSNBC, ALC would have a point of view, an agenda. Sure, there would still be random acts of God to cover, celebrity deaths and sex scandals, but that was just gravy. The meat and potatoes of their business would come from shaping the events of the day to fit the message of their network. The billionaire loved this idea of controlling the news, as David knew he would. He was a billionaire, after all, and billionaires get to be billionaires by taking control. After coffee, they settled it with a handshake.
How soon can you be up and running? He asked David. Give me $75 million and I'll be on the air in 18 months. I'll give you $100. Be on in 6.
And they were. 6 months of frantic building, of stealing anchors from other networks, of logo design and theme music composition. David found Bill Cunningham throwing snark on a second-tier news magazine show. Bill was an angry white guy with a withering wit. David saw past the small time of the program. He had a vision of what the guy could become with the right platform, a godhead from Easter Island, a touchstone. There was a point of view there that David felt just might personify their brand.
Brains aren't something they hand out in Ivy League schools, Cunningham told David when they met for breakfast that first time. We're all born with them. And what I can't stand is this elitist attitude that we're all, none of us, smart enough to run our own country.
You're doing a rant now, David told him.
Where'd you go to college anyway? Cunningham asked him, ready to pounce.
St. Mary's Landscaping Academy.
Seriously. I went to Stony Brook, state school, and when I got out, none of those fucks from Harvard or Yale would give me the time of day. And pussy? Forget it. I had to sleep with Jersey girls for 6 years until I got my first on air.
They were in a Cuban Chinese place on 8th Avenue, eating eggs and drinking paint brown coffee. Cunningham was a big guy, tall, with a deliberate loom. He liked to get in your face, to unpack his suitcase and move in.
What do you think of TV news? David asked him.
Shit, said Cunningham, chewing. This pretend impartiality, like they don't take sides? But look at what they're reporting. Look at who the heroes are. The working stiff? No way. The church-going family man who works a double so his kid can go to college? It's a joke. We got a guy in the White House getting blowjobs from those guys' daughters, but the president's a Rhodes Scholar, so I guess that makes it okay. They call it objective, I call it bias. Pure and simple.
The waiter came and left the check, an old striped carbon sheet torn from a pocket-sized pad. David still has it, framed on the wall of his office, one corner discolored by coffee. As far as the world was concerned, Bill Cunningham was a washed-up, second-rate Maury Povich. But David saw the truth. Cunningham was a star,
Not because he was better than you or me, but because he was you or me. He was the raging voice of common sense, the sane man in an insane world. Once Bill was on board, the rest of the pieces fell into place. Because at the end of the day, Cunningham was right, and David knew it. TV newsmen tried so hard to appear objective when the truth was they were anything but. CNN, ABC, CBS, they sold the news like groceries in a supermarket, something for everyone. But people didn't want just information. They wanted to know what it meant. They wanted perspective. They needed something to react against. I agree, or I don't agree. And if a viewer didn't agree more than half of the time, was David's philosophy, they turned the channel. David's idea was to turn the news into a club of the like-minded. The first adopters would be the ones who'd been preaching his philosophy for years, and right behind them would be the people who had been searching their whole lives for someone to say out loud what they'd always felt in their hearts. And once you had those two groups, the curious and the undecided would follow in droves. This deceptively simple reconfiguration of the business model turned out to bring a sea change to the industry. But for David, it was a simple way to relieve the stress of waiting. Because what is the news business really, except the work of hypochondriacs? Anxious men and women who inflate and investigate every tick and cough, hoping that this time it might be the big one. Wait and worry. Well, David had no interest in waiting, and he had never been one to worry. He grew up in Michigan, the son of an auto worker at a GM plant, David Bateman Sr., who never took a sick day, never skipped a shift. David's dad once counted the cars he'd built over the 34 years he worked the rear suspension line. The number he came up with was 94,610. To him, that was proof of a life well lived. You got paid to do a job and you did it. David Sr. never had more than a high school diploma. He treated everyone he met with respect, even the Harvard management types who toured the plant every few months, sluicing down from the curved driveways of Dearborn to slap the back of the common man. David was an only child, the first in his family to go to college. But in an act of allegiance to his father, he declined the invitation to go to Harvard, full scholarship, in order to attend the University of Michigan. It was there that he discovered a love for politics. Ronald Reagan was in the White House that year, and David saw something in his folksy manner and steely gaze that inspired him. David ran for class president his senior year and lost. He had neither a politician's face nor charm, but he had ideas, strategy. He saw the moves like billboards in the far distance, heard the messages in his head. He knew how to win. He just couldn't do it himself. It was then that David Bateman realized that if he wanted a career in politics, it would have to be behind the scenes. 20 years and 38 state and national elections later, David Bateman had earned a reputation as a kingmaker. He had turned his love of the game into a highly profitable consulting business whose clients included a cable news network that had hired David to help them revamp their election coverage. It was this combination of items on his resume that led one day in March 2002 to the birth of a movement. David woke before dawn. It was programmed into him now after 20 years on the campaign trail. Marty always said, "You snooze, you lose," and it was true. Campaigns weren't beauty contests. They were about endurance, the long, ugly blood sport of gathering votes. Rarely was there a first-round knockout. It was usually about who was still standing in the 15th, shrugging body blows from rubbery legs. It's what separated the something from the something else, David liked to say. And so he learned to go without sleep. 4 hours a night was all he required now. In a pinch, he could get by with 20 minutes every 8 hours. In his bedroom, the wall-sized windows across from the bed framed the first glow of sunlight. He lay on his back, looking out,